Yeah, thanks. So it's a great pleasure for me being here at this special occasion for Ken, who is one of my, I shouldn't say oldest friends, although we all get old, but of the people in that room here, I know among the longest. There are a few others, but he's really among those, and I always enjoyed working with him, and although we have very few joint papers, I think the interaction, we're always close, and since you will have to hear me twice today, with a second speech a little bit later, so some of this I postponed to tonight. So the topic is going to be essentially where Friedel Thielemann stopped for the coffee break, so I more or less go on immediately where he ended his talk. This is a program we started at MPA already long ago. Originally it was just Jens Niemeyer and myself. Jens was a diploma student then, and then a graduate student, and we went to Santa Cruz, and so we started all this, and it's back more than 10 years. And in the meantime, lots of people have joined this gang, and so it's not just doing the hydro, doing the combustion physics, but it's doing quite a bit of work that is also then directly related to observations, and I'm going to touch that a bit in my talk. So the standard model of a type 1a, seen it a couple of times, where binary, a white dwarf in a binary, accreting for whatever the companion is, simmering for a little while, and you know, then going boom. And so it's very simple, very convincing. The amount of energy you have available is fine, no problem with that. And you see a little bit of the complications coming in here already. It's not really stoichiometric, and as we learned in Friedel's talk, doing something with these kind of beasts, it looks kind of what one observes. One has to use tricks and tune things. And so I will mainly discuss here the deflagration models. So the philosophy behind all that was, since I mentioned in the morning in the discussion Bruno's contribution the other day, so my intention as being a theoretical physicist was to say, okay, take the kind of physics you think to understand, plug them to something that is astrophysics, do the best job you can do, and then compare the outcome with what might be around in the world. If it fits, it's fine. If it doesn't fit, so what? So that was the intention, though it's just the intention was here to understand turbulent combustion, because there's very little in the literature, in textbooks, say, of turbulent combustion, and the intention was more to understand turbulent combustion than supernovae. And it was only by chance that, because of cosmology, this whole thing became finally a hot topic. Yeah, that's where we get our money from. So the question I'm going to address here is, can we model the deflagration phase up initio without any kind of free parameters that enter the combustion model itself? Of course, stars are different and so on, so there are natural physical parameters in that game. We also have to rely, and this was more or less initiated by Kenigi's work back in 1976, with contrast in Arnett's, and saying, okay, maybe it's a deflagration, and deflagration by definition means subsonic turbulent combustion frame. And so they did this W7, which was kind of the climax of this approach, a very successful model. And so the question is, can we get something that looks like W7 from first principles? Is there something hidden there and that makes it success, that is deep physics and not just parameter tuning? And so the next question then is, okay, if you do it, how does this look like? That's addressing Bob's question. Well, we want to know, is there anything in the universe that looks pretty much like what is computed? And that's, again, dating back to Ken's work with Friedel and Yokoi in the 60s, they got very good fits, and our question is going to be, can we do that? Can we get comparable fits to observed data? And as I shall show you in the end, and here I have to make a confession, I was strongly objecting deflagration detonation transitions over many, many years. I might have been wrong on this, and many of those people on the future talks and by tomorrow will address it. It may be really that the observations tell us that something is missing in the models, and that the task is, of course, to find out what it is. It could be a deflagration detonation transition that would be an easy fit, but it could be something else. Again, in combustion physics, we don't understand active turbulent combustion, something of the sort, but something is missing. and as I said, several talks of tomorrow will address those questions. So how it all started, so those were the years of W7. You see Ken and Yuri here in the middle. Well, we all were pretty young then. Ken hasn't changed over the years. As I go through a couple of those pictures, you will see he never really changed. And if you look at the other guys here, well, they became red giants in a way, doubling and tripling the circumference. Friedel, you can see here. Actually, this is not a pirate. It is Rudi Kippenhahn, who is still the godfather of European steel revolution. His wife here, my wife, Hans Ritter, Rüdiger Wolf, who is in computing now. Anyway, so that was about when Ken visited Garching for the first time, back in the early 80s. By the way, that is going to be the only picture I'm showing where Ken is without a glass, something to drink wine, mostly beer. Since Friedel had a hard time to find those, I can complement it by really the appropriate pictures. So that's Ringberg Castle, a bit later. Again, oh well, look at this. And well, these were actually, so how that's how we looked like in those days. And and this is now coming back to more serious work. This is a standard picture of type 1a supernova. I showed it. You have carbon oxygen core, maybe a little bit of helium, hydrogen top. You ignite flame in here. Density is in normal condition. Though for astrophysics, actually, all this is moderate. We know the physics pretty well, equation of state and so on. We can compute the fusion rates. They are known. We can compute the lamina burning speed of such a flame, and it turns out to be 100 kilometers per second, which is less than per mil of sound speed, so this wouldn't give an explosion. And it's clear this was Studelitz burned, and then I have to do something about it. And I think the name of the game is turbulence, and that is known from terrestrial combustion experiments. Well, even your car wouldn't work without turbulent combustion. So the old guys knew it, and they put it in, say, in the fuel ejection or fuel putting into the engine, they stirred the turbulence, and then had a premix flame and let it go. And that's why your car engine runs with more than 100 revolutions per minute. And so that is turbulence increasing the flame surface, adding to the flame speed. So that's well known. It's also well known from terrestrial combustion that the moment you have strong turbulence, then all the microphysics doesn't count anymore. It doesn't matter. Whatever the lamina burning speed is, forget it. The burning is done by the turbulent flame rush. You have to compute the turbulent flame rush in order to kind of propagate a flame under those circumstances. And so that is the point here. We know it works. And what we found out in the 90s was that, in fact, a type 1a is pretty much what you expect for a premix chemical flame. The physics is more or less the same. Kinetics is even simpler. Scale space is more appropriate, and so on. So it's a textbook example of premix chemical flames. Now, I've stolen this from Fritz Röttger, and this is a scale space we have to cover in one way or another. The white dwarf radius out is here, length scale in centimeters. We ignite somewhere the innermost part within, say, the innermost few hundred kilometers of that white dwarf. Somehow ignition will happen. For combustion physics, an important scale is called the Gibson scale, and we heard about it already yesterday, where the lamina burning speed equals the turnover velocity of the eddies that have the right size or the width of the flame front. So up here, the only thing that turbulence does to your flame is to wrinkle it, to corrugate it. If you reach the Gibson scale in some way, more dramatic things might happen. The flame width is down here. It's very narrow. So we definitely can't resolve it. The Kolmogorov scale we would get in a fully turbulent situation, because the Reynolds numbers are so huge, is even further down than the flame width. So actually, though that is the thing we have to do. And since all these scales are so much smaller than the white dwarf radius, it's tempting to say, OK, we do something with it. You may say, OK, that's in the beginning of the explosion. One can go a little further and say, OK, what happens at later times? So Fritz also plotted that. I hope it works, yeah. So the white dwarf expands. The resolution of the 3D models goes down. You have to follow the expansion. The flame width increases because the density drops. The Gibson scale goes down. So we may come into some different regime of nuclear burning. And that's where all the discussion about deflagration detonation transition sets in, and whatever might happen there. Or something that might be interesting there. So this was actually then the time when new players came in. Well, Stan, you can see here, and Alexei Koklov, and I don't recall at which conference it was. I think Yo-Yo took that picture. But it was in these years, in the early 90s, when we started to get involved here. So here, it's the only picture with wine. All the others, you will see beer again. Like here, so that was a little bit later in Garching, a beer garden. Philip, for instance, here, Ken. Unfortunately, all the mugs were empty by that time. We changed that immediately. That's, again, around that time, now the Hofbräuhaus in München. So you see why Munich is so attractive. We have the beer gardens, we have the Hofbräuhaus. Now Garching even got a subway, and so I can strongly recommend visiting us. It's a nice place to go. Anyway, so now coming back to serious business again. So that's why we thought man might be able to model this kind of flames. You say, okay, you take advantage of the fact that this burning front is so narrow, and so you replace it by an exact discontinuity, and that's called a level set. These are methods that come from various parts of physics. It's actually like the ocean line here, the ocean going to the shore, and then the interface between water and land is somewhere given here. And in the tides, the float might go up and down. You describe that. The way it's described is by a term that is just the advection of the flow, and some turbulent term that in addition to that propagates the flame because of nuclear burning. And then you do what is called a large eddy simulation to resolve large scales, and the small unresolved ones that are needed to compute this quantity here are modeled. So that is the approach. So these were the early simulations. You saw some of them done by Martin Reinecke. Other people did similar work with different flame models. We fell short a bit in explosion energies, was something around 0.5, 0.6 beta, the best we could get at that time. It wasn't so bad, actually, but it wasn't so good either. But nevertheless, you can already say, okay, I don't care about the nickel mass, the total amount of nickel I get from such an explosion. Just look at relative effects. It's like what our cosmology friends do. They don't measure absolute distances, they measure relative distances, and get along with that pretty well. And so our point was really, we don't look at the first parameter, the nickel mass, but let's look at possible second parameters, evolution. And so people always told us carbon-oxygen ratio might be an important thing for supernova luminosities. We did some calculations here, changing the carbon-oxygen ratio quite a bit. The nickel mass actually didn't change. There was some subtle nuclear physics coming in, which I don't have time to explain. So this was done with these kind of models I expressed before. The kinetic energy, though, was of course different for these models, but the nickel mass wasn't. So it's a little bit odd for Mark Phillips' relation, but these things might happen. We looked at the metallicity effect we heard about here. So you change the neon 22 in your star and look what the luminosity, the nickel mass of a supernova would vary, changing with metallicity. We more or less confirmed the semi-analytic models of that had been done before. When we did full parameter studies, because this kind of coding wasn't all that expensive, we could do parameter studies with three-dimensional models, and this is what we did, not very highly resolved, kind of preliminary, but still you could see changing the carbon-oxygen ratio gets the nickel mass or the kinetic energy up here, changing the ignition density, changes the explosion calculations in such a way. So you get some systematics coming in, whatever the star chooses to explode at in central density, whatever the carbon-oxygen ratio was it got at birth or after accretion, all this gives you a variance in the expected luminosities of those supernovae, be of the order of, say, 10-20%, which is, of course, not the full bloom distribution of Planck normals, but might be of interest if one was going to look for systematics in big samples. Well, we tried multi-spot. That's again this kind of thing that we don't know much about ignition, and though we changed the number of ignition kernels, interesting enough, they seem to kind of converge. If you have very few, then you don't get much explosion energy. If you have too many, again, you don't get much, because the small ones immediately merge. That's one of these things with Rayleigh Taylor instabilities. Small Rayleigh Taylor bubbles rise and merge, and they form big ones. And there is a kind of an optimum, which you find kind of converge to, that gives you more or less, again, the same energy, something like 0.6 beta. And so actually, although people always discuss it's a big problem and it's a big uncertainty, within models that more or less distribute those initial kernels around the core of the star, there's very little difference. One can then also do stochastically in time, same thing. So rather than putting in a match in different places, the same instance, you do it, they spread over a fraction of a second. It was done by Jens Niemeyer's group in Würzburg, an offspring of ours. Okay, you get again some variance in the nickel mass. It's a bit more than what Fritz and I got. But still, well, there's not really in solar masses in 10 to the 33. So this is 0.4. This would be 0.6, 0.7. So these kind of models seem to give you a range of nickel masses that is between, say, 0.3 and 0.7. And it is already pretty reasonable. That's about where we want to go. Now, this looked pretty good. And of course, there were shortcomings. And these were apparent when we started to compute 3D nebula spectra using our models as input. And this was done by the Stockholm group, Cecilia Cosma. And so she took those and plugged it in, and then you of course get this oxygen line sticking up, because clearly in our models, in these kind of models, there was too much oxygen at low velocities. And this was clearly indicating, and I come back to Bruno, that was clearly indicating a shortcoming of the model. And then the question was, can we, by improving the physics, not by putting in fudge factors, get rid of this? And so we thought, well, okay, what could still be wrong in our no model. Actually, that's where we are, about where we are now. This was, by the way, Ken's Stan's birthday. We celebrated in Seattle a little while ago. And again, while you see here the red giants. But Ken hasn't changed, as I said. So what new things got into that code? Well, actually, this code is now being used by lots of computer vendors as a benchmark code. It's very successful. You can run on a few processors, can run on several 10,000 processors. And then we had to give it a name, and we call it Supernova Combustion Code for Explosion Simulations. Success. One has to have an acronym. So remember, whenever you now find in the literature, that's the name of our code, Success. So well, we thought about subgrid modeling. So the subgrid model we had in until pretty recently was the old stuff of what was developed by some astrophysicists who know nothing about combustion. And so we thought we should do a better job there. And so Wolfram Schmidt, a student in Garching then, now with Jens Niemeyer also, did a very careful job. So we really went beyond Smagorinsky's models that are kind of the model that is often used in turbulent theory. We really wanted to use the information we had on the resolved scales and say, okay, we do that and compute the turbulent flame speed. So the formula is given here. It tells you a little bit of what I said before. The turbulent flame speed is equal to the laminar flame speed, and there's this the square root here, and there's a factor here that has to be adjusted to small scale box simulations. And there here's a subgrid velocity and the laminar flame. And you immediately see if the laminar flame is much, much smaller than this here, then this laminar term cancels, and what is left here is the turbulent velocity is some factor times the subgrid velocity, which is the square root of the subgrid kinetic energy. And so the big question is how to compute this QS, QSGS. Now there are different ways how you can feed in energy in into a turbulent frame rush on small scales. One possibility is, okay, it's buoyancy. We all know that in principle buoyancy can feed in energy on those scales. And the other alternative is you have a turbulent cascade that feeds in energy from the large scales to the small scale. Now our subgrid model allows for both. It's possible to put in buoyancy, and it just looks at the resolved scales. What does the flow we compute want to do? And what we find is actually that on the scale of the flame brush, when we resolve it, the energy that comes into that scale from the turbulent cascade is an order of magnitude more than what we get from buoyancy. So if this quantity here is completely determined by a turbulent cascade, has a very small input from buoyancy, and if you would take the square root of this, the buoyancy velocity would be a factor of 3 lower than what we get from the full turbulent cascade. You have to resolve it, you have to do all that, but that's the difference. And actually, that makes a difference between our simulations and Alexei Koklov's Chicago group simulation. We get more burning just because of this effect. Our burning speeds are typically higher by at least a factor of 3. So we burn quite a bit more than they do. That's just a side remark here. Okay, a moving grid was needed. We had to go to homologous expansion to our observer friends. And this here, this little needle here, is the original size of the white dwarf. And that is at the end of the computation. So we move the grid around with explosion and can resolve this any time. So the biggest simulation we had performed until now was a full 4 pi 1000 cube grid initial resolution, about 800 meters. So we resolve the white dwarf down to scales of 800 meters, a moving grid, a local dynamical subgrid model, and this costs 1,000 hours on 512 processors, so a total of 500,000 CPU hours on an IBM Regatta system with this power 4. Well, it's not a cheap thing. And so we had to run the computer, just having it for us for almost 3 months, but at Max Planck, things like that are possible. So that's a machine. So since observers always show their telescopes, that's our Regatta system, which is going to be replaced by a system, a new system this year, by the end of this year, with a factor of 20 more powerful than this one. So we can do this kind of simulation then, say, in a week or a couple of days, for which we had needed 3 months. You get this kind of resolution now for your ignition kernels. They are very small. They are about this kilometer size. We heard the other day are the more likely ones that can grow. So we put in those. And then you follow evolution, follow the evolution until all that goes out. And then if all this is done, you're sitting on terabytes of data. And then you take those terabytes of data and visualize it, which is also not so easy doing volume rendering with it. And so we made a movie that was more for commercial reasons. That's a white dwarf. Inside here you have your flame kernels. We keep the distance, so the observer is sitting 30,000 miles away from that white dwarf, which of course is a dangerous distance. And actually you will see what happened. So I hope we can get it started. It's going on already. And so you see the simmering phase here in the middle, which I think this thing is going to give up. No, the music is not mine. Well, that's the next step, of course, to put music on that. But you see already now here the central part being burned, the deflagration front burning its way out to the surface. And now only the star expands. So in the beginning, the star hardly expand. So that's an interesting thing with that. We are now here at something like a second or so, and only after a second or so you get this breakout of the silicon fingers here that go through the carbon oxygen surface of that white dwarf. Actually, this was not a rotating simulation, it was a non-rotating one, but we thought it looks more sexy if we let it rotate a bit. And now we are out at something like, well, we're getting close now. So we better hurry and get away. And this is now the final explosion, which looks not all that asymmetric. It's asymmetric. There are significant asymmetries in here. So we are now at 20,000 kilometers, getting closer and getting closer. And then in the end, you will see that the debris got you, and now you are dead. Okay. So that is a kind of outcome of such a simulation. Now we want to do physics again. And this means I have to get the pointer down away from this damn movie. No, I don't want it. I don't have the time. I have to go. Oh, these are now the main results of the simulation. We get something like 0.8 beta, which isn't all that bad. The iron group was promising. We had 0.6. And we thought most of that would be nickel. The intermediates here were 0.43. The unburned carbon oxygen was 0.37. But what's important, the sum of these at low velocities below 8,000 kilometers per second was less than a tenth of a solar mass. So this oxygen line problem for such a model would go away. The oxygen is low enough, yeah. The oxygen is low enough, it wouldn't make a big difference anymore. The expansion velocities we got were 17,000. which looks reasonable. In fact, we don't resolve the very outermost layers, so there might be matter out there that is moving even faster. The disappointment came when we did post-processing on that and running full networks for the tracer particles. It dropped a bit the NSE part, but what's more important, the nickel mass went down to 0.33, so a significant fraction of that is stable iron group. And so this was not going to be a bright supernova, we knew that. So we handled it to Sergei Plinnikov, and Sergei Plinnikov took 92A as a comparison, that is this blue curve, and he calculated two light curves, the full bolometric is up here, and the UVAR, an observer, would call a bolometric light curve. And then you see immediately this model fits the decay pretty nicely. Here we are short by something like 15-20% in the nickel. And so this nickel we lost in the post-processing step. Whether this is all okay, it has to do with electron capture and so on, we have to have a look. So we are a bit short here in nickel, though we would like to have maybe a tenth of a solar mass more of nickel. And actually, if one takes Max Stritzinger's fits, he gets 0.4 for this supernova. So we're not so far off, and the kinetic energy and the opacities seem to be fine. And this, remember, this was not a fit, it's a prediction. Okay, the next step is, of course, you go and say, well, let's look at the abundances in some more detail. And so if I manage to get my pointer up here, it ought to be, I can start another movie. Actually, this green is the silicon fingers that stick out of this carbon-oxygen shell that is still sitting there. So the carbon-oxygen shell is pretty homogeneous, but the silicon is not. So you expect some polarization coming from this kind of model. Actually, you don't see any silicon and so on the outside. What you see at the outside is essentially, no nickel at the outside, iron. What you see is the silicon. You cut it off, and then you see why we think we will get good oxygen late time spectra. All this interior part that contains something like almost a solar mass is pretty homogeneous. There are tiny little fingers of oxygen, carbon sticking in, but all that looks pretty homogeneous. Okay, we can go one step further and to abundance tomography. So what Matthias Steele has been doing from a sequence, time sequence of spectra, feeding the spectra, we can obtain the abundances of a particular supernova in velocity space. And so we took here, the only thing we've really done a careful job on was 2002 BO. We don't expect that this fits our model because 2002 BO had 0.6 solar masses of nickel. So we can't expect that this is really a good fit. But what you see is that the overall agreement in the inner part is almost perfect. We have mostly nickel in the inside with a little bit of a mixture of carbon and oxygen and the intermediates come up. And there's a crossover here at about 1.1, 1.2 solar masses. But it's also clear what's missing in this knob run. If you compare with 2002 BO, still the nickel is fine, or the NSE is fine, but here the carbon and oxygen is up in the sky, the intermediates are too low. So we need some mechanism that burns at low densities to get that. So addressing this missing nickel in the knob run, we got another 200,000 CPU hours on a machine that is a bit more powerful than what we had in Garching at the supercomputer center in Edinburgh. And so we lowered the density a bit, and that is now a simulation of same explosion, but with somewhat lower density. And so what you expect to get out there is, of course, a little bit lower explosion energy, because we lowered the density. That's fine. It doesn't hurt us. We get a little bit less iron. But because of the lower density, we expect that this time we get mostly nickel. So the amount of nickel we lose to stable isotopes will be much less in that case because of the lower density. Intermediates and the rest is pretty much the same. Velocity is a bit low. So by taking really something that is a reasonable physical parameter, such as the ignition density, we can get this closer to the observation, particular set of observations. Now in the off-center, Fritz will talk about that, we now have the capability to do 3D light curve computations, and taking one of those off-center explosions of model of Friedel, computing the light curves, you get an interesting effect, and that is the paper being refereed right now. So the mean peak luminosity would be somewhere here, for this model 18.7 or 8.8, but you can be fooled by almost half magnitude if you look in the wrong direction. So if you by chance would see that supernova from the side, it would look pretty bright, and you would take Arnett's rule and compute the nickel mass, and you could be fooled by 20% or more. And that is the message here. Be careful, that's both a model with 0.4 solar mass of nickel only, it goes to minus 90. Well, you can then play, okay, what's the maximum you can get as a letter out. Playing these games, you can go to minus 20 with reasonable conditions, and it's Chandrasekhar mass star and 0.9 solar mass of nickel. So you don't need to go to superchandras to go to luminosities of minus 20. So, in passing, so a few remarks on subchandras. We run subchandras, and that is my two more slides. We run a couple of edge-lit subchandras because we have this nice code. Put helium on top of a CO white dwarf. We did 0.8 and 1 solar mass core, and 0.1 and 0.2 solar mass of helium. And then you get all these kind of waves interacting with this, more or less this spherical symmetric case. You can do it igniting a couple of points here. You can do it igniting an equator. You can do it, which is then a belt in this simulation. You can do it igniting at the pole. Whatever you do, almost all these models detonate. So you drive waves into that carbon oxygen core that in a way always interact such that you get a detonation. So you lit the carbon oxygen core and in the subchandra models and produce quite a bit of nickel. And that is actually what is the problem here. I think this wouldn't be faint supernovae. So the minimum amount we found in some of our simulations was something like 0.4 solar masses. And this always happens if the helium mass is larger than 0.1. And so this would be bright displays. They would have very strange spectra. So I don't think that we've ever seen those. And then the question is, can a white dwarf always, under what circumstances could possibly a white dwarf accumulate so much helium? Maybe it can't. In this case, we wouldn't be worried because we wouldn't see those pieces. Summary and conclusion. So I think we have parameter-free models here. Chandrasekhar mass limits that explode with about right energy. They allow us to predict light curves and other parameters. And the question is, where does the diversity come from? And we are talking about first and second parameters. I think ignition conditions, these kind of differences in the progenitors are second parameters. We need something that makes the first parameter, so the nickel mass, and therefore we might need that. 3D effects, I don't know. It was the Chicago approach. And the subchandras, I summarize here, they don't look like a normal supernova. Rapidly spinning CO white dwarf mergers produce less nickel. I don't have time to talk about that. If somebody wants to ask me, I can explain it. There might be the faint one. So that is my bet at present. And so to get started, happy birthday, Ken. So that is fireworks at the Harbour Bridge in Sydney. And so I thought such a movie might be appropriate for Ken's birthday. I also found on the internet exploding fireworks factories, which was much more spectacular. But I thought that connecting that to a birthday celebration, an event where several people were killed, wouldn't be quite appropriate. And so I rather said, leave it as such. And this is what I want to close. Actually, before we go to the discussion, I prepared a little gift. And the privilege of getting old is that you forget, right? And you are allowed to forget. And I forgot it first in Garching and had Stuart Sim, who's sitting there in the back, and to bring it with me, to me from Garching. And I had it now in my house. This morning I again lost it and forgot it. So it will come later, and it's a bit correlated to some of the pictures I've shown today. So it's just getting old.
You mean it's made of iron?
Not quite. There's some iron in it.
There's some iron in it. Okay, some chemical elements. Yes, Friedel, go ahead.
You mentioned varying ignition densities. In what range was that actually?
Going from 3 × 10⁻⁹ to 2 × 10⁻⁹.
Mars.
We may still lose some of the nickel, but not so much anymore.
No. So for those densities, I wanted to ask, is that at a density when the white dwarf is cold, or when it's fully convective?
The models that are given to us by Stan, so they have typical densities when they go off 3 × 10⁹, maybe a little higher, a little lower.
Okay, so in some sense...
If they are cold...
Yeah, they're cold. Okay, thanks.
Well, for the combustion physics, it doesn't matter so much. But of course, for the initial structure, it does. I admit that.
So we saw some discussion this morning in Dillman's talk about the isotopic ratio in nickel. And so what does this deflagration produce?
Well, that's what I said. We have a total NSE of 0.6 in this knob on, and 0.33 nickel 56.
Well, but the isotopic ratio. Right, the one of them.
But what most of that is iron 54, the stable, nickel 58, these kind of things. Maybe that's what I. Well, actually, the reason why now we actually get even less nickel than we had in the early days with a poor subgrid model is the following: this subgrid model now takes really care that already some convective motion or some stirring has happened before it sets before turbulence set in. There was a time delay between the start of the Rayleigh-Taylor plumes and the onset of turbulence. It's built in this dynamical model. Now this means that the star burns in a slow mode for quite some time before it starts to expand. You could see that in the movie also, before it starts to expand. And so it burns quite a bit at relatively high density. And that's why the nickel mass goes down, the nickel fraction goes down relative to the rest of the NSE. So that is something that, physics seems, it makes sense. So in the old model Jens Niemeyer was using, it was not in the sense a self-consistent subgrid model. And so this was the moment we had a little bit of shear. It told us all is turbulent, and this was burning in the beginning more violently. This model, of course, once you really have turbulence, then it goes up through the ceiling. And so we burn late, but this gives this nickel pop if you have high ignition densities. Mm-hmm.
So a subset of very peculiar and subluminous 1A. Such as 2002 CX and 2005 HK, they have a very small measured expansion velocity, something like 6,000 kilometers per second. And in all your models, the expansion velocity is something like 17,000 and 16,000 kilometers per second. So I'm wondering whether any of your models can actually produce an explosion with very small expansion velocities.
That is hard to do if you think that this kind of on average more spherical ignition conditions are correct, then I think it's no way to get that. If you are very asymmetric, then you enter into this problem, you might have a detonation on top, and then going back again to a very powerful explosion. So my bet really is, if one looks for the counterpart of the mergers, that's where one has to look. And it's so you see, the reason why, and this gives me a chance to discuss it. The reason is if you have a rapidly spinning white dwarf that is Chandrasekhar or above Chandrasekhar, and then you ignite your flame somewhere in it, wants to grow, has Rayleigh-Taylor instability. Now the point, it can do that very easily along the pole, but it can't go sideways because there the matter has the wrong angular momentum. So you suppress the Rayleigh-Taylor sideways, and so the net effect of all that is that these rapidly spinning ones that could be a result of a merger will produce less nickel than the non-rotating ones. And they might have even high masses, super Chandra, but my suspicion is that these kind of objects, if they come from merger, they would be rather, massive, could have low velocities, would produce little nickel, little luminosity. So that's a bet. We're working on that, and maybe in a year or two, I can give you a preliminary answer. But that would be, for the time being, my suggestion.
Yeah. In 1D model, I have to use kind of parameters and to compare with 3D. So the important parameter is the frame speed. Mm-hmm. And in your latest 3D models, which not too much deviate from spherical symmetry, how much is the maximum frame velocity relative to sound speed, or
it's still
how much
of the order only a couple of percent.
Only a couple of percent. Yeah. That's slow.
It's still slow. But the point is really the fuel consumption rate is not just the flame velocity, it's the flame velocity multiplied with the surface area of your flame. So you can come up to very high fuel consumption rates with moderate velocities provided these flames have a big surface area. And so these 3D models generate the surface, and therefore you can get along with this lower local speeds.
I was interested in your discussion about the origin of the diversity, say the spread in luminosity, which you attributed, I think, to a viewing angle for.
Well, this was one model.
One picture was that, but I think the you know, the success of fitting the supernova luminosities with light curves is really quite good.
Yep.
The scatter that's left over is pretty small.
Yes.
And you know, it's so. You may have too much of a good thing, is what I'm saying.
I just tell you, read Stu Sim's paper. We played that game, Monte Carlo, with this kind of model, and the scatter we get in the Hubble diagram, the theoretical Hubble diagram, is about 2/10 of a magnitude.
Well, that's
so we don't disagree
with
what you see.
Yeah.
Actually, we thought that if we would get now a scatter of half a magnitude, we can forget it. It would just tell us hugely asymmetric supernovae don't exist. Right?
Or we don't see them.
Well, okay, we don't see them. Okay. Well, they would be bright, you would see them. And so that was our argument. Actually, we thought we might get some constraint on these asymmetries from looking at the scatter.
Right.
But the Hubble diagrams we constructed are within the limits given by the observation. Okay. There's no constraint yet. But if all these effects add up in an uncorrelated way, then you still stay with this 0.1, 0.2 scatter. But if some mechanism there would add up in a correlated way, then of course we might already get constraints. And that's actually where we come in. So that's the ambition, to go from the model, from the systematics in the model, to constrain the model.
Sure, because there might be a hint in the spectra
as well, there's a viewing
angle. Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
So for the asymmetric explosions, do you see the spectral diversity with the different viewing angles?
We haven't done spectra yet.
All right.
So the opacities that are in our code yet are gray. So we can't do spectra. We're on the way to try to do it. Well, what we get already as a difference is that the brighter one should have a slightly shorter rise time because of this nickel thing. Mm-hmm. And we would also expect an effect in the colors. So we're just looking at temperature and all that, we can estimate already what the color would be. So there would be an effect in the colors and the rise time correlated with a scatter in peak luminosities.
Well, I think this will be really interesting, right? Because you'll have a good sample.
And the temperatures work in the right way so that more luminous ones are hotter.
So that's okay. And so we looked at that. That looks, on average, quite all right. But you see, it's just a first step to see what might be hidden there in this kind of data set. You get now your huge data sets. One can break them up and do all this kind of analysis. And the theoretician might guide you in what to try to correlate.
So if possible, also, you might want to look at the polarimetry to see if the wing at all resolution.
On the to-do list.
This factor of three difference between you and Chicago on the subgrid flame propagation is potentially crucial. Could you say just a word or two about why you think you're right, and maybe more to the point, whether there's some experiments, numerical or otherwise, that one could do to test this?
Well, this will be in part addressed also by Fritz Röpke tomorrow in his talk. The bottom line is that, as I said, our subgrid model would tell us if buoyancy would be important, because there is a term in the subgrid model that takes care of buoyancy. Now, with this fully resolved, with this highly resolved model, we really see in scale space of a factor of 20 or so, Kolmogorov turbulence. It's not being put in, it comes out of the numerical simulation. And then we looked at it again and said, why is it? Why is it not, say, the buoyancy that adds to this and changes the turbulence spectrum, which it could. This is what's called BO scaling, so people, if you feed in energy into a curvilinear cascade on different length scales, you might get a different scaling behavior. And then we looked at the relative importance of these two terms, the energy coming from the cascade and the energy being fed in by buoyancy, and this was an order of magnitude difference. Although, if we would play it hard and say we forget about the turbulent cascade, we would get something like what the Chicago group has and low burning rate speed, but of course that's not physical then. Does this answer your question?
I think so.
Fritz will show the spectra tomorrow in his talk, so I had to leave some of this highlights to him. And so I didn't show it here.
There's smaller scale calculations.
Yeah. Well, we did box simulation that actually confirmed that, yes.